231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 34th annual Hawthorne Street Fair, Sunday, August 27th on Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. The Hawthorne Street Fair, now in its 34th year, features music, activities for kids and adults alike, entertainment, local businesses, and community vendors. Again, that's the 34th annual Hawthorne Street Fair, Sunday, August 27th from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. on Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
Hi, you're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 90.7, and I'm your host, Jake Vermoss. Today we're talking with artist, poet, and educator Lauren Camp, passing through our city by way of Santa Fe for her new book, 100 Hungers, out by Tupelo Press. In addition, she is author of two previous books of poetry, The Dailiness and This Business of Wisdom. Well, I was wondering, next, could you read a couple poems to introduce us to 100 Hungers?
I'd be glad to. So I'll start with a poem called Pause, Hawk, Cloud, Enter. The soup cooks for an hour while vultures and buzzards pluck the market. My father wipes his forehead with a white cloth. Once each day began with hubs and samoon flat and hot from the griddle and sips of sharbat with sandalwood petals. Those beside the river were not aware of other places. No one knew how long the water ran, trying to get where it had never been. My father hears nothing, and nothing becomes the gate he walks through. There is nothing but what has been erased. Listen to the clumsy way he watches the pigeons, and his laugh when they lift a few streets off. It takes a whole life to make a man. But there was a day he raised his overstuffed suitcase, the day he was sent for, the day the desert lost its pungency. That day denied him one future and brought him the trampled ground of another. My father dines on his languages, garlic and lemon, on barley and river. There is hunger and hunger lined up on his spoon. Candied apricot, yogurt, his sixth birthday, his seventh. Take the pot from the flame. I was born on ashes, cotton and silk left in basements, on old candelabras and alleys, on someone else's recent past, on clotted sky. How do you live in silence? You talk to absence. You eat, tasting the steam. The ingredients vary. You smash the door. You erase and erase until what you've kept is transparent. You watch the earth in the window, your body browning. The book is also about my childhood growing up with the culture and rituals of Arabic, the language, the food, all everything that I could connect to his culture. The book goes in and out. It sort of interweaves his childhood, very much imagined and researched, and my childhood told as a myth. So I'll read you one other poem that is about my childhood and has virtually nothing to do with Arabic culture, but called Small Mathematics. In school, she allows Sheila to calculate braids from knot twigs and tendrils, the earnest punctuation of hair over hair. The requiem of touch insists she listen more to that than the equation of words spilling from the teacher's mouth. Sheila's tickle and pluck at her scalp, how each narrow strand alters layers of tresses, and the comfort as hair grazes her earlobe as it drops onto bones of her shoulder. These small, tidy things, so exact and quaking, each gesture of pulling.
I think you read the first one in Mother
Proposed. I did, yes.
The line that really stood out to me is, how do you live with silence? And you talk to absence. And that really just kind of haunted me. And I was, and also your story that you shared when we read together Mother Foucault's the other day about your father's reticence in sharing these details about his childhood. And could you share a little bit about that for our listeners who weren't able to be there, about how exploring that part of your family history as a child and how that changed when you learned something?
My father, reticent is such a generous term for what he offered. He didn't tell us anything, and it never occurred to me to ask anything, as though I knew he had come from another country. He told us the date he arrived in the U.S., and it was almost like his life began then. But he came to the U.S., and he was 15. So obviously he had a whole childhood elsewhere, and I knew where. I knew the country, I knew the city, but that's about all I knew. And it wasn't until, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago or so, that he mentioned a detail that sort of unlocked, for me, an interest. He said he was born in Batawin, and that was just a curious, interesting term to me. And in fact, it was the name of the place is in one of the very short poems in the book, and was initially going to be how the book was going to be arranged. It was going to start there. But when he said that, I went looking for a map of Baghdad in 1935 when he was born, trying to figure out, what is this? Where is this? And saw the Tigris River and saw where Batawin was relative to that. And suddenly I had hundreds of questions. There was something about its tangibility that I could suddenly see where his house might have been, where, you know, where he might have walked, where the river was relative to where he lived, that I started caring a lot and asking questions. And by that point, my father didn't answer, probably couldn't answer, but he definitely did not answer, and I didn't know why.
Wow. So at the time, you weren't sure if that was just his choice or if there was some kind of remembered trauma that kind of kept him from wanting to revisit those?
Right. Exactly. I still am not 100% sure, but I do know that that there was very likely trauma. This my father's family, extended family, were Iraqi Jews. So they belonged in Iraq. That was their homeland, and it had been for generations, but they were suddenly things, you know, or going into the time of Nazi Germany. And so there was this combination, this confluence of problems that changed a perfectly peaceful society into a society in which the Jewish people were no longer welcome in their own homeland. And then the State of Israel formed, and that further sort of exacerbated the whole problem. And of course, I didn't know any of this, and I didn't know, you know, when I started researching, and I, it was really easy to find that kind of history.
Was the broad sweeps of what happened.
Exactly. Right? What was hard to find was my father's awareness of that. Like, how much did he know? How much was he impacted by that? You know, what was the family situation, his immediate family, my grandparents, who were, you know, an arranged marriage, there were six children, what was happening in their household, on their street, in their alley, in their, you know, and so trying to understand that was harder and has remained harder.
Yeah, because, I mean, I imagine, you know, as any child or human being, really just to know about their origins, you know, on some level.
I think some of us want to know desperately. And I don't know, I find it actually frustrating of myself that I did not want to know as a child. That it, was it an like an unspoken barrier that my father put up, where he said, I came to the United States October 12, 1950, and it didn't occur to me to say, well, but what happened before? Or was I just a thoughtless kid? Or, you know, like, right. It's hard to know. And I think also most people want to talk about themselves and their past, but if there's trauma there, or if you're starting over, having talked to a lot of people from a lot of different, where their relatives, their parents, their grandparents came from other countries, a lot of people said, we're starting from here.
So I've been reading a little bit of Fred Moten lately, who writes a lot about jazz and kind of writes poems that kind of enter your body like jazz too. And there's a quote of his that I really liked, where he talks about, you know, his writing process. As I'm in conversation with Donne and Shakespeare and Baraka and Mama and my grandfather and, you know, Louis Armstrong and Charlie Patton, all these people, they're in my head and they're in my body, you know, they're sort of animating my flesh, disrupting the body that I guess I thought was mine. Even though you don't specifically talk about ghosts, who would you say that your work is in conversation with and who might disrupt your body in that way?
First of all, I think that's a fantastic quote because, well, I think that idea that you don't have a direct linear, like it's all jazz musicians or it's all whatever. I think my writing is in conversation with a bunch of musicians, jazz musicians certainly, a lot of artists, minimalist artists, modern artists. As a visual artist, that also strongly impacts me. And I think it is in conversation with ghosts is a good term, the ghosts of my grandparents long before I knew them, especially. My grandmother was 14 when she got married, was in arranged marriage to her first cousin, and had her first child a year or two later, and had children every 2 years for the next 14 or 15 years. And
pretty regular.
And I think about that, and I think I only knew my grandmother in one really specific way, as my grandmother, as an old, she seemed like to me an old woman, who did all this phenomenal cooking for her family and was very quiet. So you talk about silence and absence. She and my grandfather didn't speak the language all that well. I never thought to ask my dad questions. I never thought to ask them questions. But her job was to feed us, and she took it really seriously to feed her extended family. And, you know, and I think about that, like all the things I didn't know. All the ghosts that sat at my grandparents' table when we would eat.
Right. I had a similar experience with my Filipino grandparents, who didn't really have a lot of formal training in English. There was that barrier of nuance and vocabulary and everything. But the language that they used to show us that they loved us was food.
Food.
And they cooked so much for us. And they were always kind of feeding extended family and sometimes strays we picked up, friends that we invited over, and I sometimes wonder if they were also sort of feeding the ghosts from their past that they didn't really have the names for.
Yeah, I think that idea of hunger and nourishment and caring and just, you know, attending to basic needs, and food becomes a basic need for keeping that culture alive through recipes, through spices, through, you know, the different ways, the different
names even that you bring up there.
The different names. I mean, in some cases, writing 100 Hungers, you know, like I don't speak Arabic, but I knew the names of all the foods because,
right.
You know, if instead of calling things meatball, we would call it kifta or, you know, whatever.
Right.
You know, you would have the names, and that was just the term you use. So automatically that Arabic goes into your body.
Right.
As a, you know, young Arabic girl with no other language skills in that that language.
That's powerful stuff. Kind of as somebody that's trying to go through my own sort of family history and interview people, what are some of the, could you describe a little bit of the process that you found getting around the silences and making that absence present through either indirectly through other family members or your own memory, or how did you mind that?
Making that absence into words and rhythm of a sort. I wrote first of all about the foods. I wrote about everything that I could remember. So there's a poem in the book about going with my father to work when I was three, going on the New York City subway into Wall Street, and just the different ways that I connected with my father. I went through every document I had electronically in folders, things I had never read, that I had, like eulogies and speeches, or whatever I had that had been sent to me. I found some history. I went through books about, I read a couple of memoirs about people who had grown up in Baghdad and then emigrated to Israel for the most part. So they were different stories, but I was just gleaning information where I could. I had three details from my father. The one I told you about Batuin, I had one about my father marking the bricks in their courtyard, I guess, or their backyard, with the names of his brothers when they were born. Oh, wow. And that was a really poignant, powerful detail. And I had one other detail, and those went into the book. Those were like gems. They were like, I'm not, yeah, and they were his. And since I was trying to tell his story, whatever was his, I was keeping. Nobody.
And give an agency where, you know,
he
didn't want to willingly give you a lot of that.
No, and he wouldn't give me anything intentionally. And they were going in verbatim. Like, if anyone was going to edit those out, I was gonna put my foot down and say, nope, that's Dad's. That stays. And then I went through foods. I went through recipes. Recipes were relatively easy to find. Music was another way I mined memory. I listened to lots of Middle Eastern music. Without lyrics for the most part. And it happens that I listen to lots of music anyway. So I have a very large collection of oud music and Baghdadi music. And that was comfortable to me. It was familiar to me. Another way that I mind, in a way that I mind sound, was thinking about the language. Even though I couldn't understand it, the sounds of Arabic appeal to me. The
very lyrical
and very raspy and guttural, and you know, it would be really different if I were writing about Portuguese. So that became part of what I was after. I went through my own memories, every memory I had relative to that culture, every memory I had of being at my grandparents, because they had emigrated to the U.S. and to New York, and we lived about an hour away. And every memory I had of being at that long table with my cousins and aunts and uncles and extended family, and the foods that would be put out, and the prayers, and the, you know, all the ritual.
All the nuance.
Yeah.
Was that a regular feature of your life growing up, the get-togethers with?
It was. It was probably every 3 weeks or so, or 3 weeks. Yeah. So
pretty close by.
Right. So we were about an hour away, and it was just something we always did. We went every couple of Friday nights, you know, every few weeks. And so I had that experience of the foods and the and just the being there around. So a lot of that worked into the book. Thankfully, I had my own memories.
Yeah, it's very detailed. I mean, the amount of were you surprised at the amount of obsessive focus that you brought to kind of gleaning all that and pulling those strands?
I didn't think about it that way at the time. I mean, it's actually lovely to hear that in a way, because at the time I felt like I felt like I was, I just seemed so hard. I kept getting stuck because I felt like I didn't have enough information. Mm-hmm. And some of what I didn't have was the feeling, that the tangible, the tactile feeling of Baghdad. Mm-hmm. I just had no way to know what the air felt like, know what it felt like to be, you know. So I went to be in that, in the market, for example. So I had to kind of go through, well, okay, I've been in other markets, you know, and yeah. But trying to do justice to this, to a place.
Without being able to visit, too.
Exactly. To a place around, halfway around the world, that doesn't exist this way anymore, and trying to do justice to it as though I were a growing boy. It was hard. Yeah. It was frustrating. It was hard, and I kept feeling like I was stuck. So it's nice to hear that you get the obsessiveness. That's what I kept getting stuck on, was how do I do this right? Have I done this right?
Yeah, it felt almost as if you were unable to drop it, like drop it as let go as a thing, and before. You had exhausted every sort of possible scenario.
Exactly there. True. And you know,
I am
the type of person that if you give me a dare, I will do it. And I think that was sort of buried underneath all this, was the dare of, can you possibly do this right? And I wouldn't let it go until I had gotten it as close as I could.
Because it seems much more personal than a lot of your other artistic projects, and there's that sense of I guess needing it to mean something.
It's more loaded, I think, in a way.
It's fraught.
Yeah, it's, you know, are the portraits I did of jazz musicians personal? Well, yes, but not in the same way this is. Mm-hmm. Not in the same way that I'm trying to capture my father's memory, though he would not give it to me. And have I done this right? And it didn't matter whether he approved it or not. Ultimately, the parameters of the project were, have I done this right so that it feels right to me? Not so that I could give him the manuscript and have him say, yes, you got this. Because in fact, that ultimately didn't matter.
The secondary.
Yeah.
Were you able to ask some of your aunts or uncles or grandparents while you were researching?
My grandparents were not alive at that point, yeah. I had a few relatives I was able to ask some information of. One of my father's cousins, but you know, again, they have very different, even though they're part of this extended family, very different experiences. Mm-hmm. So one of the female cousins of my father said, oh, your father was a prince, and that was like gold. That was just, I was like, oh,
that's
my
very
God.
Specific.
Oh my God, that's in here. I wrote that.
I remember that.
Yeah,
line.
A prince of the city. Yeah, mm-hmm. I put that in there. I was like, wow. So I was really just, I was hungry for all that information. I mean, I was like ravenous for what, by the time I decided I wanted to do this, I was desperately hungry for it. And then there weren't that many avenues to get that information.
Yeah, there's definitely several different kinds of hunger that you talk about in here.
Right.
Would you be okay with reading a couple more poems?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I'll read you a hunger poem, a poem about food. And I often describe 100 Hungers as a book that's a love story to my father. The book is about him, it's not for him. Right. So here's a poem very much about that. It's called Butter and Prayer. The girl's father is the divinity of a pomegranate, a pith capping the slow mantra of seeds in the rich sweat of juice. He is a fried egg on a plate, simple and circular, a feast of pistachio and apricot, a pot of rosewater tea. She walks with her father toward banquets of meatballs, platters of rice, toward tables stacked with a surfeit of buttery hope. She grows her hunger to suit him, and thrives at his side. He is a platter of tripe. His love can be tasted. She doubts nothing, eats everything with a rigor of claiming her parent. But where the sacred spread of food ends, so does the taste of her father. And then I'll read you a pantoum from the book. A pantoum is a very old, and it's a repeating poetic form where two lines, you basically write four lines, and it carries through over the poem, and then the poem begins to write itself. This is a very abbreviated way of describing this form, but the poem sort of directs and begins to write itself. So there, every line repeats.
It's a regular rhythm with that.
In a way, it's regular, but it's not as regular as like a 4-4 beat kind of.
Okay.
So this is a pantoum about him and his family leaving, and it includes some words that I maybe ought to define. The first two words, talit and tefillin, are Jewish prayer garments, and then a little later it mentions the souk, the market, the Dijla, which is the Tigris River, and Sahra, which is desert. Pieces of leaving. Gather everything. See the scar on his leg? A talit, tefillin, brown boiled eggs. May God save them from danger. They learn to leave again, less prayer than body in continuous sun. A sympathy for starting over, the possible, all they can hold. A talit, tefillin, brown boiled eggs. May God save them from danger as they tend and pack the rose and mirror and trousers. A sympathy for starting over, the possible, all they can hold. What's been taken away is the truth, not the warning. As they tend and pack the rose and mirror and trousers, each wearing only the blessing of his or her reason, what's been taken away is the truth, not the warning. Their hands entangled, they deal in defenses. Each wearing only the blessing of his or her reason, the death of King's Faisal and Faisal ajar from the river, the photos. Their hands entangled, they deal in defenses. They needed the souk, the Dijla, and Sahra. The death of King's Faisal and Faisal ajar from the river, the photos. They learn to leave again, less prayer than body in continuous sun. They needed the souk, the Dijla, and Sahra. Gather everything. See the scar on his leg?
Love the question at the end. There's so many questions that are in here. It could be almost 100 questions, but there's probably more. So,
Absinthe sets up a million questions. It really does. It's
right.
Well, what did you wear to school? Where did you sit? I mean, it's everything from the tiniest to the grand. You know, the
yeah. And you don't give a lot of answers. It, the space kind of allows the reader to come up with our own stories ourselves.
You're kind of in the same position I'm in a way, as the reader. You know, I have more information than you do about this culture, perhaps, but I don't have all of it, and so I couldn't give all of it.
Right. And so what is it specifically that you think about the form allowed it to kind of bring that specific poem to light? Because
the pantoum? I think the pantoum has a few things going for it that are perfect for me. In general, it's why it's the form I like to go to a lot. But for this particular subject, it was useful. It's good for obsessive things, for things you can't let go of. It's also good for, I think, when you have a subject that you don't know how to tackle. I think form in general is good for that. But the pantoum. It gives you some kind of structure because those lines repeat, and they repeat in specific areas, specific locations in subsequent stanzas.
Alternates too.
Exactly.
Right?
So it goes, you know, you take one and three and you move them down to two and four of the next stanza, and everything moves down. And so it's sort of offset in a way. But then what it does by repeating and leaving space between it is you have to fill in those gaps
right.
with something, and then those repeat. And so it's circular, it's obsessive, it leaves openings, but it leaves openings where that's what they are. They're like doorways. You have to fill in the space between this line and this line, which are pretty much set. So what are you going to put in there? And that's a valuable way sometimes to write something where you only have limited information.
And that's a valuable way to allow the reader to participate too, because they're not a passive kind of consumer of that kind of form.
It's an amazing form because it was designed for like public forums long before we had we had books, or so people would be listening for the lines that repeated, kind of like the ghazal, you know,
right.
the you would be listening for the end words so that the whole crowd could say them out loud, right? And it's a wonderful form.
Yeah, great. And do you have any events coming up at the end of the month that you'd like to tell us about?
I have a reading for the Spare Room Reading Series with Claudia Savage at Passages Bookshop, August 28th. I would love to see people there.
Well, that's where you can find Lauren. And thanks so much for joining us, Lauren Camp.
Thank you, Jake.
I love you.
We love you too, Michael. And we love you for staying with us all these years. Be with us again on Thursday, August 24th from 8 p.m. to midnight as we have our 10th and final annual tribute to Michael Jackson on Guess Who's Coming to Radio. We will be focusing on what music made the most impact